And I'm not a really good American because I like to form my own opinions.
Huh? What?
There's tons of examples of corporate greed, inequality, and disregard for the environment that make people wonder if markets are evil. And they are.
Maybe Lise is right about America being the land of opportunity. And maybe Adil has a point about the machinery of capitalism being oiled with the blood of the workers.
Where it's like, hey, wake up, liberals. You can't always do, sometimes you gotta, but that's actual quote from Karl Marx.
In recognizing a communist, physical appearance counts for nothing. If he openly declares himself to be a communist, we take his word for it.
If I were to ever start a country with a communist government, wink, wink, wait 12 years.
Men are seduced by communists, women so much so that they deem communism nice. Communists murdered mostly the Nazis.
Bottom-up horizontal connection, sharing at all levels is key.
Describing as anarchy. Are you an anarchist?
You mean, am I a member?
An anarchist group, yes.
Anarchists have a group?
I believe so, sure.
What kind of garbage is that? Oops, my anarchy symbol.
Hello, Albany. It's the Three Left Show. This morning, 10 a.m., October 13th, here at WCAA, The Voice. I have a voice in Albany, if you haven't heard that promo cut I made. I'm your host, Dan Platt. This, for the next 2 hours, you're going to hear left-wing talk. If you don't like that, you got to deal with it. So this is a radical left-wing talk show for the committed or the curious. And I hope for the next 2 hours, I'm solo for the next while. So, but that means I can really kind of pace what I'm going to talk about and bring things around full circle. What do I mean? Well, I'm going to start these 2 hours talking about Kanye, and I'm going to bring it back around to Kanye in the next 2 hours in such a way I guarantee I will blow your mind. So the big circus news this week was Kanye had a working lunch, quote unquote, with our president. And many will say he made a fool of himself. I agree, of course. Who am I to judge? Who am I to disagree with the people in my community? My validation gang. I'll get into what that is later. But otherwise, I think I watched the full 10-minute clip. It was like the last third, I guess. I guess his rant was a half hour, I'm told. In the last 10 minutes, I listened intently on what he was really like. Because under all that rich guy garbage and lack of book learning, because if there's a case that one should read some minimum amount, Kanye has said publicly he doesn't like to read. He never liked to read. I guess it was a skill he never learned, or maybe he's dyslexic. I don't know. But another case, he's anti-books. That goes to explain quite a lot of how he speaks and what he speaks about. But under all that rich guy garbage, I heard something about abolishing prison labor. I like that. You know, he frames it in terms of abolishing the 13th Amendment, which made slavery illegal. But, of course, then there's the byline saying that slavery is okay if you're a prisoner. Meaning, we have modern slavery in America is in our prisons. And who is arrested most of the time? Black men. So what's changed? That's the point. But he can't make it. He's not the right person to make it. Now, there are other people that could have been invited to the White House. Michelle Alexander and a bunch of other activists and, you know, the people who can articulate the arguments for, you know, but of course we have a president who's a game show host. So you need an equal brazen TV personality or entertainment personality to convince him of something. And it's been a pattern that, you know, whoever speaks to him last, you know, he'll nod and like, you know what, that is a good idea, because he doesn't have any self-judgment or whatever. Especially if it's coming from another rich guy. So I was hearing a lot about, like, he was making the economic arguments, because who else but a successful business person to make the case that we should abolish slavery for business reasons, because that's a great way of going about it. sarcasm. And then he ended with showing off the design for a plane that he didn't actually show the cameras. And that's where I lost it in a fit of laughter, hysterical laughter. But he also was mentioning Jacquet, you know, because he was going on like, you know, a stream of consciousness. And he was, but then he was like, he was putting in, to me, buzzwords, dog whistles, but like good dog whistle, the progressive kind, where he was listing out like educate, like we need to fix the schools in Chicago. And that means, you know, there's the Waldorf school model, there's the Montessori model, we're going to put in it meditation. You know, he didn't mention tablets or techno fixes, which is what, you know, is a red flag for me. But he was mentioning all the things like, oh yeah, he's talking about free schools. Ending prison labor and free schools. Buried beneath all that garbage, he was actually mentioning things that liberals would like, but because he's wearing a red hat and he's talking to Trump and making a show of it, then it's about the presentation that everyone's really hating on, rightfully so. But why is the circus centered around Kanye, right? He has cultural capital, and that will come in later. So maybe I gave it away already. So I want to bring that into the discussion. Now I'm going to shift to something a little more serious and muddled in the details, something postmodernists do. But it's government policy, boring, wonky stuff here. But I will always strive to connect it to our own lives and also interrogate it to say, like, is this what we should be focusing on? Is this a policy to, like, talk about? And if not, then how is it clue us into what we should be talking about? What I'll be talking about later in the hour and the next hour. So if this is from CNN Business, so I guess it's fake news. Wink, wink. The government just made it easier for workers to own a piece of their employer, says the headline. So in a ceremony last week, the president signed a defense bill, as we have one every year, $717 billion for the military and our wars. Buried in the near 800-page bill, I thought this was about making bills shorter, was a provision he didn't mention, or anyone else really, but this one is. It's one aimed at addressing wealth inequality in America. Go figure. Sneaked into the bill was the military bill was a secondary bill known as the Main Street Employee Ownership Act. What a great name. The mandate was tacked on by Senator Kirsten Gillibrand of New York. Her goal, help more workers to own a piece of the company they work for. Concept, employee ownership, is gaining traction. Now, of course, when I ever talk about employee ownership, I'm talking literally in employee management, worker management, seizing the means. That's what socialism is. This is not that. This is employee ownership of stock in the company. And they don't actually control it, by the way. So here. So the most common way, this is the way that our system allows for in the most, you know, in the most easy way, is through the what are called employee stock ownership plans. That's known as ESOPs. Workers pay nothing to participate. Oh, good for them. The company takes out a loan to buy the shares from previous owner or shareholders, then divides the shares among the employees. Now, granted, and by the way, I'm always going to be interjecting myself when I'm doing these things to break things down, and also interject other ideas, such as, say, a union actually wants to do more than just bargain for higher wages, but let's say the union then meets with the bank to take out its own loan to buy a majority of shares in a company. So then the owner, the union representing the workers, then actually own the company. But this is the company then buying the shares as a proxy for the workers. Profits from the employee-owned portion of the company are tax-free, so the tax savings can be used to pay off the loan. As co-owners of the company, employees vote on major events like mergers and spin-offs, but a management team still handles day-to-day decisions, of course. Now, it's mentioned that most of these employee stock ownership plans, they do not own they do not make up a majority of the stock, but usually a minority of it. So it's not like the workers have this voting power to override the other stockholders that are just in it for maximizing their income and don't actually produce anything. So let's see. The average participant of an ESOP today has a share in their company worth close to $120,000 on top of any other retirement savings, allowing them to build equity in their job like they might build equity in a house, assuming you own one. The company must buy back an employee's shares at fair market value soon as they retire or leave the company. The plans were formalized by Congress in 1974, while some notable companies like Wana and Publix supermarkets offer them, they remain a modest part of American stock holdings at a mere $1.3 trillion. Mere. Well, I put in the word mere, but a modest part. That's their word, modest. Modest $1.3 trillion. Although the number of workers invested in ESOPs have risen steadily over the years, the number of total companies offering such plans has actually declined significantly. So let's see, since from 2001 to 2015 is the graph, it went from like 7.5 million to 10.5 million. That's number of employees with these plans. But the number of employee-owned companies, meaning companies doing this, having ESOPs, went down from 7,500 to 6,750 or something. Went down 1,000. So let's see. So here's some of the background. America is facing a wave of retirements by baby boomers, like my parents, who in 2012 owned nearly half of the privately held businesses in America. Half. Many of those will simply dissolve if their owner can't find a buyer or a family member to take it over. I'm sure in all our lives there are examples of this. You know, old family businesses, and there's no one to buy them from them. And they're only thinking about who can I sell my business to instead of why don't I give it to the workers? Why don't I reorganize it and then train and spend a few years, the last few years of my working life, training. I already probably have sub-managers, so on. So here's where Rutgers professor Joseph Blasi went to Washington about last year. He directs the school's Institute of Study for Employee Ownership and Profit Sharing, has advocated for greater employee ownership via stocks over the years. He met with both parties, hoping that further tax preferences for so it's just for tax policy here, through ESOPs could be incorporated into a GOP tax plan. And it is something that Hillary Clinton included in her campaign platform. And I paid attention, and when it was said that Hillary Clinton moved to the left because of Bernie, they're talking about including this policy of encouraging ESOPs. And we'll get to how they're encouraging ESOPs with this bill, which has just been made law. And I think it will not excite you. Doesn't excite me anyway. So Gillibrand seized on the idea and she convened a bipartisan group. Oh, the bipartisanship. It's so good to see that. A group to come up with a plan they could pass. So pragmatic. Mirroring conservative sympathy for small business owners with liberals' interest in boosting workplace democracy. It's an interest, but I don't see it often. But here's an example of where it is seen. So I guess there you go. Another key selling point, the package doesn't cost anything. Rather, it directs the Small Business Administration, federal agency, to make its loan guarantee programs more readily available to employee stock ownership plans and worker cooperatives, which often have trouble accessing capital through the regular banks. I wonder why. It also makes it easier for a business to transition to worker ownership. I'd like to know the details of that. But again, it makes it easier. So it's up to the business owner to decide. That's my major gripe here, is that it's leaving it up to the small business owner. owner still has the power in this relationship. Now, if workers organize, form some type of union or association, they can probably access these loans as well. So in that way, it's a positive step. And if you're an incrementalist of the type of, you know, reform capitalism and all that, then this should be exciting and you should be talking about this. Let's see how many emulate what I'm doing. I'm talking about it, and I'm a hardcore socialist who doesn't think this is far enough, but as far as an incremental step, I give it the thumbs up, more or less. Will it work, though? Well, it definitely helps, says the professor who wrote it. Hassini Vizion, different person, the executive director of the Rocky Mountain Employee Ownership Center, a Denver-based nonprofit that helps small businesses convert into ESOPs. Okay, so I'd rather we have more nonprofits converting businesses into co-ops. And they do exist, but they need to be bolstered. Vizion had hoped the legislation would have created a new department within the Small Business Administration to foster work ownership. That would have been a better step, yes. But she says building the expertise at the agency to facilitate loans is a step in the right direction. Access to capital is the next best thing. It's just the silver lining. Even as an incremental step, this could be a stronger policy. But, you know, it's got to be just in the form of loans that you have to pay back, and, you know, no gifts, no actual help, because it's not like our banking system is working against you. Oh, wait, it is. And then it gives an example of a company that has done this called New Age Industries. How appropriate. Talk about a co-option of counterculture. But by far the single greatest enemy to this is awareness. From a political standpoint, there's a lot of support. Problem we have is that because everybody likes it, it just can't get the attention of things like defense or crime. Imagine we do things we like instead of just fighting things we don't like and spending billions, trillions on that. Last week, I covered more practical, real-world examples of things, and I always strive to do that as I talk about heady topics, which I will now be doing for the rest of the hour or so. But I hope you'll find it entertaining and informative nonetheless. Why do I preface this? Basically, the next topic. So I'm going to be reading a blog that I've read before called Human Ammonia. It's a Medium blog, but it was a link to me. Or rather shared on Facebook, by one of my boomer friends, who his kind of subject comment was, for my old kind of left-leaning friends, this is what serious lefties are talking about these days. And he has an excellent point, and I'm going to actually prove him right by talking about this at length for the next section here. So the title is, If the Point of Capitalism is to Escape Capitalism, then what's the point of capitalism? Subtitle, what would happen if we gave each other the things capitalism tells us to keep from each other? So I really like where this goes. So I'm going to read in full, or at least I'm not going to chop it up. Here's a question that keeps recurring to me these days. It goes like this. If the point of capitalism is to escape capitalism, what is the point of it? I know it's a circular and funny query, so let me explain. Here we all are, all trapped in by this grand global system that is called capitalism. It reaches into every nook and cranny of our lives, orders our wants and desires, plans our days and nights, and structures our time and energy. You can even talk to capitalism like it was a person. Hey, Alexa. A system by which we mean something like profit-maximizing corporations, owned by shareholders, run for that one sole end. No matter what the cost is to anyone or anything, people or planet. But what's the organizing principle of life that this system, which is so pervasive and premeditating, produces? What are we really trying to accomplish with our economic system? Well, a worker usually tries to become a manager, and the manager is trying to become a capitalist. I put that in modern terms. I could put it in Marxist ones just for contrast's sake, that a is trying to become a petit bourgeois. The bourgeois is trying to become a haut bourgeois. The worker, a shop owner. The shop owner, the owner of a chain. Even maybe in the small way of owning a home, which is to say, paying back its debt all their life, or buying a stock or a bond and so on, the point is to amass capital, money capital. So capitalism is something like a pyramid, which are all climbing, worker to manager, worker pro to bourgeois, and at the apex is capitalist, part of the ruling class. But what is the capitalist trying to become? Well, a capitalist, ironically enough, is trying to earn his freedom from the system he enjoys, just like everyone else. The only difference is he's a step closer. Here's a proof example of a simple and extreme example, that of a plantation or enslaved owner, the truest capitalist of all, not so long ago even. What is he really after? He's trying to earn his freedom from labor, not having to do work, hence the slaves. He's also trying to win freedom from exploitation. He who holds the whip is above any moral law. And from control, punishment, and hierarchy. When you're the boss, you have no one to answer to. Perhaps he devotes his life to more gentlemanly pursuits, art, literature, discovery. But what's the point of these? These two are a freedom from capitalism, from its bruising stress, pressure, anxiety, and the competition. Now he, because as playmates go, they're usually men, is free to really be himself. Good for him. But do you see my point? How funny and strange it is? That even the capitalist is really just trying to win back his freedom from capitalism, to buy it back, properly speaking. But so is a worker or the underclass. So is the small business owner. So is the wage slave. Whatever term you choose, depending on what your politics are, the point remains the same. So, my friends, are we all the point of capitalism is to escape it? Now, most systems are self-perpetuating, like a forest, river, an ocean. But some systems are self-annihilating, like a fire, like a storm, like an epidemic. They burn themselves out. We tend to think of capitalism as the former, but we're usually wrong. It is the latter. Sorry, the former meaning a self-perpetuating one. Capitalist realism, it's the only thing we got, it's the best thing we got, nothing else is needed. But it's really the latter. It's the self-destroying one. If we're all trying to escape it, then what else could it be? After all, that means that there will probably come a day when we do make all our escape. And on that day, poof, capitalism, at least in the sense above, winks out like a storm, like a fire. So if we see for a moment through the great lens of human history, first there was tribalism, and we escaped it. Then feudalism, and we escaped that. Today, now, there is capitalism, which we're currently trying to escape all over again. If we ever have actual socialism, we'll probably be trying to escape that as well. I put that in there. And while kings and knights might not have been so keen on escaping feudalism, what's striking about capitalism is that we're all trying to escape it, even most capitalists, because it makes us so miserable, mean, and foolish. No, that doesn't mean there aren't bad eggs whose only goal in life is just amassing more money and using it to abuse people. Sure there are. We have one for president. Still, just the idea that even capitalists might be trying to escape the system too will probably upset both those on the left and the right. Because I'm going beyond just Marxian thinking and suggesting class war is just as limiting as capitalism is the sole end of human life. To think, though, that this is the idea often taken for granted now in Europe, thanks to modern thinkers. So you can see in stark comic terms, what are Bezos and Musk doing? They're trying to flee to Mars. What's Gates doing? Recommending you books to read and trying to save the world with charity. LOL, how ironic. These are different forms of freedom from capitalism. Maybe on Mars, we can build a better world. Maybe through ideas and philanthropy, we can solve the problems that corporations can't. All the capitalists I see are trying to win freedom from capitalism one way or another. I think Trump's way is being president, but who knows? There are many people who, having amassed fortunes, seem under the grip of a kind of compulsion. They must turn 10 million into 100, 100 into a billion, and so on. This is what Marx called fetishization. Later thinkers like Adorno and Fromm from 20th century would have said that such a person is still trying to escape the system, only they don't know how, the poor things. They're trying to buy love, affection, belonging, meaning, and purpose. They're trying to win the very same self-discovery and self-realization our genteel bourgeois is after, devoting their life to literature and art once he has made his money with a bigger yacht, a mansion, and bank account. But you cannot really buy those things in this world or the next, meaning, happiness, and so on. So it's true to say that mega-capitalists aren't exactly monks, but I don't think that means they're not trying to escape capitalism, too. They're just trying to buy their way out. In some ways, there are many tech entrepreneurs that have. Like, they made $1 million. I'm adding this in. They made $1 million, and they just retire at 30, meaning, like, they don't really have to work again. You know, they set up some investments so they'll never be poor. And then they basically just do whatever they want. They found companies that don't have to make money. I use a search engine, DuckDuckGo. It doesn't record your searches. Okay, wink, wink. Check it out. And it was created by this tech entrepreneur guy who, you know, did something not so great, made $1 million, and then with that, he has made a search engine for no purpose except to actually protect your privacy instead of take it and violate it. Back to the article, or the essay, rather. But then there are many people who are the mirror image. They are not trying to become Bezos, Musk, and Gates. They're just there doing their jobs, earning their wages, and going home. Could that be you? It's true, many of us are trying to escape capitalism by making our peace with it, surrendering to it, in a way. If I do this much work, I might never get rich, but at least I'll have left a piece of this many hours a day. At least I'll have my hobbies, my interests, my passions. It's a calculated bargain, apathy, which is always a kind of capitulation in the end. And it only proves the point. We're all trying to win our freedom from capitalism, rich or poor, poor or bourgeois. Now let me distill the things we are trying the freedom for, from capitalism. Freedom from exploitation, freedom from control and domination, freedom to find, develop, and realize ourselves, the freedom to live lives which really sear us with meaning, purpose, and fulfillment, instead of being crushed. So here's the real question. If these are things we are really after, why don't we just give them to one another? Perhaps that sounds trivial, but let's put it in perspective. This is probably the first juncture in human history where we are really capable of giving these things to one another. We've never had the physical capability before. Until this point in human history, we needed armies of laborers doing the work providing subsistence, farming, accounting, driving, and so on. But now, finally, our technology is automating away repetitive, formulaic labor. Not just in the way factories did before, churning out canned consumer goods, but in a real one, replacing all other inputs, tilling the fields and balancing the books, directing the deliveries, and so on. You know, all these AIs and other technologies owned by capitalists, so they're, you know, but he's just giving them as new things, tools. Tools are always neutral. Nor have we had the financial means. If we wanted to give people all of the above, how would we have done it? We had no way to give everyone the means of what today is starting to be called a basic income. Would everyone line up at the central bank? Today, everyone can open an account online at a central bank and poof, there's money. If you really wanted to, we could make freedom from capitalism a financial reality almost overnight. Money is, in fact, created out of whole cloth in bank accounts. That is true. Then there is social technology. Social institutions, public goods, public investment. Only in the last century or so really have human beings really become capable of operating things like healthcare, transport, retirement for elderly, childcare, and so on at a social scale. That is because these things require post-capitalist management too, which we're still learning how to do. I mean, who owns the National Health Service in the UK, for example? It's held in trust by communities. What does it maximize? Neither profit nor planning. But healthcare outcomes, which are measured carefully, not in Leninist, Stalinist ways, nor in American capitalist ways, but a kind of 21st century post-capitalism at work. one made of public goods and public investment. These three things, tech, finance, and public goods, have finally matured and developed to a degree that freedom from capitalism isn't just possible, it's becoming inevitable. What's really happening is these three forces intersect. Society's surplus is being reinvested back in precisely the very things we are really after. Instead of being skimmed off by predatory elites, the swamp, freedom from exploitation, control, and so on, to realize and develop, and he repeats that list. And that is an imminently good thing. It tells me that the obsolescence of capitalism is inevitable, as that of feudalism before it. That doesn't mean that trade and enterprise and creativity will go away. Of course not. Quite the opposite. It means that they will be generally more beneficial. We can devote them to better things. At last, the money, status, power, and egotism, which is what capitalism limits us to. And through that limitation, by perpetually draining away our empathy, wisdom, our very courage, truth and happiness, causes us to desperately wish to escape it all of our lives, no matter if we are rich, poor, or somewhere in between. Now, the big obstacle then is, you know, those at the top of the pyramid and those that get a direct paycheck from them. Let's say, what's to stop us from sharing resources, even on a block level? Laws, police, you know, coercion, organized violence. I'll get into that later. And there are these obstacles. It's usually obstacles of the state and of our own ideas and mindsets. So I share this point of view to mull over and let that stew. Yeah, I'll summarize. So we're all trying to escape capitalism here. Makes the case for that. And we're always trying to climb that ladder, and at the top of the ladder, we're free. That's where we're actually free, both in the negative sense that no one can touch us. You know, we can actually commit crimes and you can get away with it because the justice system is as much capital, money-based, as anything. Interestingly, actually, this is what I can spend the next 5 minutes on, is how laws work. Like, in the best and sincere way, laws are a compromise between the ruled and the rulers. This came to mind when I was discussing my new role. I've just, you know, I'm not all talk here. I've just stepped up to be a assistant or backup shop steward at my place of work, grocery store. And because I want to learn the ins and outs of, at the very least, this corporate union, you know, this older, been in the biz for many, many years union. And it's very, the mindset of the union reps was very apolitical. It was all about enforcing the contract. And the contract, when enforceable by people like the union and its representation and its stewards, is like justice, right? It's a contract that, in essence, all of our laws should be based on contract. Contracts we agree to that we actually have to sign and be a part of the discussion. That is justice. Because most of our laws don't actually involve a lot of our input, there is a feeling, as well as a reality, my opinion, that many laws are illegitimate. Not that I'm going to go around breaking all of them at will, but I'm going to bend and be flexible and jaywalk, at the very least. It's a muscle to break rules. To, you know, if you don't work it out, then you can't really break the rules when you really need to, like to save your life or to save someone else's life. And rules are a matter of, like, you know, the rules that are followed are a matter of contract. You know, union contracts are followed based on the fact that everyone ideally took part in negotiating them or voting on them, had a voice, and fought for them. A lot of anarchists, you know, how would anarchism work? Is a probably question when, if it was ever comes up. And it's basically, it would work by via contracts. Community agreements on this is the commons. You know, everyone has access to it, but here's what you have to do and here are the rules you have to follow. and we're all going to talk and discuss democratically how those work, and then we all agree to the contract, which is the law. And that's kind of almost all of the impetus behind all laws. But for a mass amount of people, you know, we do it through elected reps and senators and all the rigmarole of our government. And, of course, how a lot of it's captured and ruled by money. And so it's not really between people and their interests and needs, but the top of the pyramid, rulers and the ruled. And it's a compromise of, you know, we'll have a set of rules that everyone has to follow. But lately, perhaps always the case, rulers have always been able to circumvent the law. Harder when it's a union contract or a contract that's made more directly. You know, I'm for direct democracy, direct governance. When it's indirect, you have all those openings for abuse, the creations of the swamp. Not a metaphor I always like, because swamps actually serve an ecological function. Just not a function for, you know, human habitation, let's say. So I get that. Of like a future society, we use contracts to decide that everyone should get their share, have access to things, because our technology is developing at a pace where we have zero marginal cost, which is basically, it takes so little effort and resources to actually make things. Or effort itself, you know, 3D printing, the way that a lot of media is zero marginal cost. You know, you can copy a file infinitely. It takes no more effort or resources, unlike before where you had to make the records and the CDs and all that other stuff. You have to pay for it and you have to get it somewhere. Now it's just the energy and, you know, you set up renewables and away you go. Can we get there? Well, there'll be a lot of people in the way. There will be a lot of forces, metaphysical or otherwise, and we need to organize to fight it. Okay, moving on. I'm probably going to make some haters here, but I do this with love. I'm going to talk about 9/11 truth randomly. Not so randomly. A meme was shared by a friend of mine, good friends, but this is something we disagree on, fight over bitterly, I suppose. But I usually let it go because, obviously, it's not that important. This is trivial. But it's a talk about another type of concept to introduce it, and it will come into play later. I promise. So first some nuance here. Okay. So there is, in fact, a policy of the truther, you know, 9/11 truth movement, and that is to have a new 9/11 commission. In the aughts, way back when, in 02, 03, I guess, they finalized it in 04, I guess. It took them years of work, and it was a big, like, book document. And it was plagued with interference by the Bush administration, and eventually its work was cut short. Much like the Moreland Commission here in New York, which was investigating corruption until they got to the governor's office. Similarly, 9/11 Commission was getting close to the actual truth, and they had to be stopped. Most likely connections between our government and the Saudis, obviously were declared allies and all that. Saudi government funds Wahhabism, groups like Al-Qaeda, and all those groups in Syria like ISIS, they get material support from Saudi Arabia. But we buy oil from them, and that's more important than any amount of violence. And sometimes their violence helps the U.S. empire, our military-industrial complex. It helps their stock prices as they go up every time there's talk of war or bombing or increased bombing, which many Democratic senators also call for from time to time. So anyway... So there's got to be a lot of digressions at this. This is really stream of consciousness, though I do have some notes. Question that comes up to mind is, like, did the truth movement, it came about very soon after the 9/11 Commission ended with that Loose Change YouTube documentary when YouTube was new. Although I suppose it did not start on YouTube. It was created on its own page. And a lot of conjecture. To me, a lot of bad reasoning, logic. You know, you look for a conclusion that the government is hiding something. What are they hiding? It must be nefarious. It must be that they actually did all of it. So you kind of start from a conclusion, and it becomes a lot of confirmation bias. Possible. Then the other, let's see, then there's, I time to think that, like, was there a window of action where, like, was it in the Bush administration to get a new truth commission? Was it in the Obama years? In the last, you know, those 8 years, you know, there hasn't really been a big campaign. You have this quote-unquote movement, right? But you never, have they ever actually lobbied? Do they actually build organization and support for a new commission? No, it's really just a bunch of squawking. And I say this with love, that you gotta, if you're not actually building community and what are we gonna do to force the Fed to actually start a new commission? I mean, just having commissions into corruption, you know, it's like drain the swamp. Well, I don't see a Senate committee on fighting corruption, okay, or public financing, you know, we used to, but not anymore. So what are the goals, you know, right? You know, especially now, it's been so many years now, and it's basically just wind it down, but now and then, amongst people I know, it still flares up, and there's still a sharing of memes and reminders that this was a thing, 9/11 truth, and that there's an insinuation that it's controlled demolition, and rather the towers collapse by fire, or that steel buildings can, in fact, collapse by fire. Because it's kind of an absolutism that if the government is lying about one thing, which, by the way, they do about all the time, every war, every justification for war, the U.S. government historically and presently lies about it. This I do not dispute at all. When it comes to how buildings fall down, I can, because I trained for 6 years with knowledge, taking classes about material science and structures and statics and doing the math and being explained and reading books, actual books, not just lists of architects saying that something's fishy about the 9/11 Truth Commission. Kind of reminds me of the doctors who get together and say the vaccines are bad, and or that evolution is, I'm skeptical of evolution. It's a joke that it was in a skeptical movement. That's like, well, I can find a number of scientists named Steve that are for evolution, or believe, you know, that use evolutionary science to our benefit, and I bet I can get more scientists named Steve than on petition than your petition of scientists that are skeptical of evolution. And not only did they match the numbers, but they got like 10 times more of just scientists named Steve. Quite funny. And I wonder if one could do the same with architects that are skeptical of the conclusion that the World Trade Center can collapse by fire. Now, some small details to that effect. Because it was brought up that, like, well, the World Trade Center's own engineers said that it could survive a plane impact. Well, okay, plane impact, but that doesn't mean fire. There started fires, and there was everything in the towers that was burning. And metal doesn't have to melt to be weak enough to fail. It just has to be hot enough. And the fireproofing was especially cheap, pointed out to me, via my professors and stuff, and they're not part of it, okay? Promise. 2 inches of gypsum board was the fireproofing in the World Trade Center. 2 inches of gypsum board, okay? Plane breaks that chite all the way through, and then there's no fire protection at all. And then, by the way, even then, it would just protect for 2 hours, and that's how long it held up, right? And the same goes for Building 7. On the inside, it was on fire, completely on fire. There's smoke coming out of the building all day, a fire raging all day, weakens the superstructure implodes, and then the building comes down. Okay. It's not like it's never happened before. It happens all the time. When steel was first being used as structure for buildings, going back 150 years, it was proclaimed by the engineers that these were fireproof buildings because metal, unlike wood, doesn't combust. They were wrong. Their buildings were on fire all the time, and everything, including the structure, would fall over. Much like declaring the Titanic unsinkable, there are always unforeseen factors like terrorism and plastic burning and all kinds of things. But all that aside, you don't have to believe it. The question of, like, why does it matter that the towers went down by controlled demolition? Now, usually when it comes, and this goes to a broader point about conspiracy theories and so on, is that it's usually a cover for a truth that's even more frightening. And of course, why am I even talking about it? Why do we even care whether people believe towers were brought down by fire or controlled demolition? I think there's a helplessness of sort, as seen by the truth movement. They're completely impotent, helpless to actually do anything. And it's also kind of a resigning, almost a faith-based, you know, and then apologies to anyone who's a devout Christian or devout in any way, as far as your faith and religion goes. But just like, it's like saying, when you say it's the lizard people, it's like saying it's God's plan. There's nothing we can do about it. It's mysterious. And we have no part to play in our society. And there's a helplessness to that that defeats us in our communities and how we act and in fighting injustice. You know, there's the injustice of how, you know, we don't know what kind of support Saudi Arabia or these Saudi terrorists had from the U.S. government. Maybe they did, maybe they didn't. Likely they could have. But we don't know because it hasn't been fully investigated. Maybe that's what was put an end to. But it's all conjecture. And to say otherwise, which happens in these arguments, whether what are these loose conglomerations of people who agree on this, I'm going to introduce the term validation gang. Validation gangs come in many shapes and sizes. It's a concept created by a guy named Peter Coughlin, YouTuber. Okay, so interesting ideas and theories and whatever are coming from YouTubers now because they're like the millennial academic. And instead of being cloistered up in the ivory tower, they are musing and researching and, you know, and lecturing on via YouTube as a platform. And it's amazing. Trans women YouTubers are our generation's Kafka. True fact. So a hidden truth that you know, conspiracy theories are usually trying to supplant is that instead of just saying or concluding that 9/11 and all other terrorism are spectacles from which our pre-existing system of capital and military industrial complexes took advantage of to expand the U.S. empire in the Middle East. Now, did these forces arrange for the terrorism to happen in the same way that it can be arranged? No, and so, or was it an accident? Was it simply happenstance? Historically, it's been the second, that something bad happens that wasn't pre-planned but was taken advantage of. And if anything, the conditions for the bad thing to happen, the bombing of the Maine, the Gulf of Tonkin incident, which by post hoc released record didn't actually happen. So maybe in another 30 years, all the 9/11 truthers will be vindicated. But right now, what is their ramblings accomplishing? They're fighting for a new truth commission, right? To get to the bottom of it, to whether vindicate them or not. And whatever it says it will likely vindicate them, however they say. Either it will not, they won't agree with it and say that, oh, this new Truth Commission's just as phony as the last one. Or it will, and it was right, and they were right all along. Very pragmatic of them. Where else can I go with this? You know, there's an objective thing. Oh, yeah, yeah. Conspiracy theories give us an objective thing to focus on. Focusing on a controlled demolition. Oh, yeah, and also in these threads, it was thrown at me just as often that it was controlled demolition was, and that towers can't collapse by fire damage. It's just common sense. Just common sense. And then just as often, it would be told, you need to listen to the experts, Dan. The experts say it couldn't have fell by fire. It had to be controlled demolition. Well, which is it? You know, so a validation gang. Validation gang is like any clique. You know, we all need emotional support. We all like being told that we're right. And we all kind of need that, the kind of support that we're on the right track, doing the right thing, emotional support. We all have it. We all need it. We all give it to each other. And there's nothing sinister about that. But what is harmful is, especially on online niches and cliques, but it happens in real life too, the cliques develop and you have a group of individuals that may not have real solidarity for each other, or may not be, or not an actual community, don't actually have each other's back, but just validate each other. You know, the circle jerk. And in online forums and in real life, of just agreeing for agreeing's sake, and oh, aren't you right, and to have your opinions, and all, we're all right together. And if somebody disagrees, has a dissenting opinion, or wants to inject some nuance, they are then made the out-group. And it's especially heinous if they're actually one of the thought leaders. So validation gangs can also develop around thought leaders. Your Jordan Petersons, your Joe Rogans, your Kanyes. That everything they say is gold, and if you don't think so, then get the hell out of my face. You know, you're the enemy, the out-group, not part of this community of free thinking so-and-sos, of people who know the truth. So it's not just the hammer on 9/11 truthers in that movement, because it's not really a movement. I call it that out of respect, because that's what they would refer to themselves as. And I wanted to, you know, I do respect these people. They're some of my friends. And so I'll plug, I'll end the hour by plugging 9/11 debunking site. It's just called Debunking 9/11 Conspiracy Theories. It's the debunking911.com. That's it. Oh yeah, you know, the personal story of like my training. Was I indoctrinated in college? Am I now part of the sheep? The out group? I'm not sure. I'm uncertain. And that's okay. But I'm certainly not going to fall into a existential skepticism. Interesting video I just watched, which compared the metaphysical skepticism, which is the one opinion is as good as another, we can't really know. We're just to continually ask someone, how do you know this? How do you know this? It's like coleslaw. It's not very interesting, pretty boring, and you definitely don't want just coleslaw on your plate. You know, if you see every issue as one opinion's good as another, that's fine if you're comfortable. And if you're in the ruling class, or if you're, you know, doing okay economically, then there's no stakes. You know, you can just, you don't want to fight anyone. You don't want to shake any boats. But of course, if you're struggling, if you're a worker, if you live in the city, there is usually some kind of injustice befalling you. And we need to break out of that skepticism and start stating things, start seeing, you know, replacing the objective, one thing is the problem, with there's a system and we're trying to escape it. So let's talk about how to escape it and work towards that, or to have something else, so on and so on. So thank you very much. This has been the first hour. See ya.